Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Kenan Trebinchevich. Hello, Kenan.
How are you?
Very good. You've written a book called The Bosnia List, A Memoir of War, Exile, and Return. We appreciate you spending a little time with us on the program today. Tell us how you decided to write this. What happened?
Well, 2 years ago, I had a physical therapy patient named Susan Shapiro, and she's a journalism professor and a memoirist, so she would never pay attention to her exercises, so every time I would walk away, she would pull another stack of essays to grade. So when I walked over her and jokingly asked if the assignment was what I did on my summer vacation, she said, actually, the first assignment I give to my students is to write 3 pages about your most humiliating secret. So I looked at her and laughed and said, you Americans, why would anyone reveal that? And she said, because it helps you heal, and editors want unusual voices. So that night I emailed her to ask her how her back was feeling. So she sends me an essay her student had just published about how her and her mother, a Holocaust survivor, ate bacon cheeseburgers on Yom Kippur to cope with the anniversary of the suicide of her father. So I felt that unlocked something within me. And being a science major, and obviously not an English major, I've never written anything in English before, I decided to try. So the first 3 pages I wrote and rewrote wound up in New York Times Magazine, and later on were chosen by William Woolman's American Best Travel Anthology. So Susan told me to keep writing and invited me to her book seminar, where I met the WME agent, who agreed that I should expand into a memoir. So next day, Susan asked me to write a 3-page flashback scene, and I said, no way, it's not happening, it's too long. However, that following morning, I came back to her, and I showed her 43 pages. And that's how this project was started, and I asked her to join the team to help me put this together.
You were just a young boy living in a city in northern Bosnia, and life was good. And then war broke out and everything changed. Tell us about this city where you lived and what your life was like before everything happened.
I never had a curfew growing up. I was 12 years old. I've never seen a crime scene, never seen an arrest, gunshot, even a police car speeding down a road. It's very peaceful. City had about 90,000 people along with the outskirts. And as the tensions started, to me, as a 12-year-old boy, I always believed that the wars were always fought between foreign countries and people who spoke foreign languages, such as I always used to watch Battle of the Bulge with Dad or Bridge on River Kwai, you know, the World War II movie in Japan. And then one day waking up and realizing that it's our neighbors and friends with whom we shared birthdays, you know, weddings and holidays would turn on us, you know, it was quite shocking to me.
You were living in what we call Bosnia, and here in the United States, what we read about Bosnia was mainly about Sarajevo, but you were actually in a city just across the river from Croatia. You'd never even been to Sarajevo.
I drove through Sarajevo on the way to karate camp down in Croatia, and our city was strategically located in northeast Bosnia because Serbs were using that city as a corridor road to connect east and west Bosnia in hopes of, you know, creating greater Serbia. So whosoever hands the city ended up with, you know, it does change the tide of the war and either kills the dream of greater Serbia or allows it.
Mm.
So it started like a month before, like in March, beginning of March. And war in Brčko started May 1st of 1992. And we were actually stuck in the city for 11 months. We were occupied.
Kenan Trebinchevich joins us. His memoir is The Bosnia List. You noticed something had changed. Your family was Muslim. You never really thought much about that. You weren't very observant. And then suddenly, your favorite teacher was being mean to you. Your karate coach was being hostile to you. Some of your friends were being nasty, weren't they?
Mm-hmm. Well, first off, started with the coach who started alienating me from the karate team, and then he formed his own. Then he started missing on the weekends. He wasn't showing up, and he would always come back scruffy, hungover, and tired. And later on, we learned that he was one of those weekend warriors who went to Croatia to fight against the Croatians. And then when the war started, he showed up. He came to my home with an AK-47 and an angry army troop shouting, "You have 1 hour to leave or be killed." That's before he took my dad and brother to a concentration camp.
Oh, my.
And then with friends, same thing. We started playing soccer games, but different teams. They would say, "Oh, Serbs on this side, Bosniaks on the other side." But I'm sure it goes back to parents and what parents were preaching and telling these 11 and 12-year-olds at home. And then once the war started, I mean, they got control of the city, so we became occupied and pretty much stuck, you know, before we were thrown out of the apartment.
And you and your mother and father and older brother watched as all this happened, and before you knew it, you had no electricity, you had very little food, you were basically trapped in your apartment, weren't you?
It was, I mean, for 10 months, we're stuck in our barren apartment. We're tormented, and by neighbors, we would be kicked off the buses at checkpoints, had guns pointed at us. In a way, they wanted us to leave, but they didn't allow us to leave. So they'd rather have you die there, and or get, sent to the camp. But yeah, one day I tried turning a switch on. There's no electricity. Food started to get spoiled. There were old Turkish fountains everywhere, all over the city, with fresh, clean water. So that was our way of getting water. Well, it was actually a way of me getting water because my brother and father were fighting age, so they had to hide indoors from the enemies. So it was my duty to get bread, look for food. And, as I'm being harassed by neighbors or denied food, such as bread and oil, in the stores by the same people who used to once ask me, how's the school going, Kenan?
Mm.
My mom's friend said to me, they referred us as Turks. You Turks won't be needing bread pretty much soon, so tell your mom that. Or your line is over there. Wait for your own food on the side.
You had one neighbor in particular. Was it Petra?
Petra, yeah. She was our next-door thieving neighbor who befriended my mother in an odd way. She would walk over and say similar stuff. You Muslims are going to be defeated pretty soon, so you might as well give me your skirt. You won't be needing any much longer. One day she told my mom, "I like your rug." So, of course, my mom gave her a rug because we don't know if she was going to turn Dad and Eldon, my brother, in to military because they were constantly looking for people in the buildings. And so next day she invited my mom for coffee, and there they were having coffee over her old rug, her stolen rug, should I say.
Kenan Trbinčević joins us. His book is The Bosnia List, A Memoir of War, Exile, and Return. Then this couple showed up from Belgrade. They were essentially looters, weren't they?
Yeah, Bonnie and Clyde, that's what I refer them to.
They were scary. They were terrifying, weren't they?
They were terrifying. She was I can still picture right now, bleach blonde hair, lots of lipstick, camouflage uniform, and white Adidas sneakers. And, I mean, they just looked at, they were standing in the driveway, and I was peeping out through the windows, kitchen window, looking down at my old friends, trying to figure out when can I avoid him so I can go and try to get fine bread. And there she was standing with her husband, who was towering over her. And they started coming over our apartment and taking our stuff piece by piece. And at one point, having my dad unscrew our chandelier from a ceiling and made my father carry it in a wheelbarrow from our apartment to hers. And the apartment which she stole was actually one of our family friends' apartments.
And you discovered that she had just this practically a warehouse of stolen goods that she was taking. You weren't the only one that she was robbing.
No, she opened a garage door, and there were lamps, stereos, tables, carpets, washing machines, VCRs. Obviously there weren't DVDs back then, like VCRs, big TVs, anything. And a ton of candy, and I knew that candy was stolen from homes or from stores, But they described themselves as fighters of Arkan Tigers, who was a very famous paramilitary thug based out of Belgrade, who, you know, whose troops raped and looted homes after the battles, of course. Mm. And there were these people who usually were gathered from jails or another place called Red Star Belgrade, which is a soccer team. So they would find, you know, the most thuggish hooligans to be part of this gang.
Mm.
And so they would always say, well, you know, we were walking over Muslim blood the other day and whatnot. I don't know if they did or if they were. But they were, you know, they were thieves, pretty much.
And you're a young boy. You describe a couple of situations in the story where this woman, whether on purpose or by accident, lets you carry her AK-47. And in those
Uzi.
In those circumstances, you thought, I could kill her right now.
Yeah, the first instance was at home where when I walked and I saw this pile of candy, and it looked like it was underneath the Christmas tree, or it belonged underneath the Christmas tree. And when she went to the bathroom, you know, she gave me a kiss on the cheek for helping her bring one of my mother's belongings to her home. And I felt that I was, like, cheating my own people by eating candy, like, you know, being greedy boy, eating my own people's candy, which she stole, and made me really upset. And I thought, well, I can easily offer right now, because if someone comes in, like her husband, he won't believe it's a 5-foot, 100-pound boy. They're probably going to think it's someone who is in competition with them, you know, stealing from other neighborhoods. And, you know, but then, of course, what my parents think about it, and my mom always said, don't be like them. So mm-hmm. she allowed me to hold the Uzi, and I looked at her, and I pointed at the nuzzle at her, and I didn't smirk. Her smirk left her face as well.
Uh-huh.
And then I think she realized what I was thinking, and then she said, okay, time to go, and she snatched it out of me, from me.
Oh, my.
And then the second time was when she made me come at 11:30 at night past the curfew at the local makeshift bus station. She was coming from Belgrade. She promised to deliver paperwork from high up the ranks, Serbian ranks, for us to leave the country, and it would be pretty much in exchange for the apartment they would give her. And when she came off the bus, she said, no, I have no papers for your family. And that's when I knew that she probably never had any connections. She was nobody. And I couldn't believe how much my mom would actually cry and be disappointed. So when she handed me her bag, heavy bag, which happens to be filled with jewelry, she also handed me by accident Uzi. So I had it on my, strapped over my shoulder. And when I was standing behind her, I wanted to point it at her and call her name so I don't come across as a coward shooting in the back. But then she quickly turned back and said, oh, I need my cigarettes. And then she realized I was carrying her gun, and she made a joke about it.
Mm.
And I made a joke that I never knew it was there because it was too dark.
Kenan Trebinchevich joins us. His memoir is The Bosnia List. And you've structured this book so that we go back to the time when this was happening in the war, and then we flash forward to more recent times when 19 years later, you and your brother and your father made a mm-hmm. trip back.
Yep.
And you had been simmering and stewing and very angry for all these years about what had happened. And you made up this list, which is the Bosnia List. And you went back and you had these things mm-hmm. that you wanted to know.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that.
I never made a sense of how and why we survived. So my co-author, Susan Shapiro, she would quote Joan Didion's line, I write to find out what I think, and it turned out to be very true. So I felt like a mouse in a maze where every time I remembered another story, there would be one more roadblock I needed to find my way around. So while I started out feeling like a victim who lost my childhood, you know, I came to understand how amazingly lucky, you know, we were. So in the process of writing, I felt very immersed into the story. So I had to regress to the age I was during the war and now make sense out of it as an adult. So it's very soothing and addicting at the same time. So Susan thought, well, I think this can be a great structure to go back and forth. And it should be really smooth, fast read, of course, and very understanding for Americans the way we structured political history through my family's history. After two decades in America, my father desperately wanted to visit Brzezinski again. He had a stroke in 2001. He fully recovered, other than losing his English pretty well. and his widow and my mom died in 2007, and he's always been a wonderful father, so we didn't want to deny him the trip. So at first I lied to myself that we were doing this for dad. However, I realized it was time for me to face down my past. So I was told by other survivors and friends, oh, it's normal when you go back for the first time, you're going to have these fantasies of revenge. He's like, we all have it. Because what happens is when you leave, in a way you left your part of yourself there, so you always feel that age that you were. So when you go back, I still felt like a 12-year-old boy who was kicked out. And so I made my own list of confronting certain people just to make sense out of what happened and why it happened.
The book is The Bosnia List, a memoir of war, exile, and return. And Kenan Trbinjevic wrote it with Susan Shapiro. He joins us on the program today. You're getting ready to go out on book tour. Are you nervous?
Actually, it comes and goes, but I'm very comfortable now. And I've done went to a conference down in Texas, a college conference, and first speech I ever given was my life was in front of 350 people. Mm. And I've been doing this for 2 years. Obviously, it's my material, and I'm really excited to go and, you know, share the story. I mean, at first it started off like as a personal matter, but I felt this immense obligation to tell the story, not only for my family to have some form of healing, but most importantly, all my Bosnian people, all those Bosnians who defended independent Bosnia, and for anyone who has ever been persecuted for their religion, nationality, or ethnicity. And at first, when I heard that I was coming to Dayton, I felt very reserved, because to me, Dayton, most of Bosnians, doesn't hold a special place in our hearts. But I'm very excited to go there. As you know, it was noble that the Americans finally intervened to stop the killing by forcing us to sign a Dayton Peace Accord. But what was contradicted was their own policies for democracy and human rights with the miscarriage of justice, because the Serbs were rewarded for the genocide by being allowed to keep the land that they occupied. We all have a question for Richard Holbrooke, even though he's deceased right now, is, we were getting killed, slaughtered for 3 years, and so how come right away as the tide of the war turned, we were threatened with airstrikes by NATO unless we stopped advancement of freeing the territory of Serbs. So many refugees like us from 1995 could not ever return because of that. And as you see what's going on in the news right now, all the protests and roots are the reason of Dayton Peace Accords, the day they were signed, and inequities and complex administration with in a country of 4 million people who have over 26 ministers and every county having its own government police administration. So hopefully when the hands are off Middle East for a little bit, President Obama and Vice President Biden can turn back to Bosnia, because I feel that they're the only ones that can actually nullify the peace accord and unify the country without having these entities who constantly want to separate into their own nations, specifically the Serb side.
You make this very clear in your book. You say, quote, unfortunately, NATO, led by the United States and Britain, intervened. It was the worst blow of our lives when Western leaders imposed the deeply flawed Dayton Accords in November 1995. The treaty unfairly ended the conflict before we could rightfully win the war we were forced into. For us, that meant we were never going home. So you're hopeful that some of this will be rectified and made better?
I mean, it has to. 40 to 55% unemployment and huge corruption on all three sides, and, people are suffering because of it. And, of course, all the leaders on three sides like the conflicts, because it keeps them in keeps them in power. They promote fear. But in the book, I also quoted the reason NATO intervened and English and French and Russian involvement. Clinton tapes published in 2009, actually he disclosed inequities, saying how French, some NATO members like French, believe that independent Bosnia is unnatural.
Mm.
It does not belong in Europe. And British, French, and Russians favor the arms embargo against us because he went towards our disadvantage. And the British reminded Clinton of restoration of painful Christian Europe.
Mm.
And it's really interesting because we were probably the most secular Muslims in the world. And we're in a region where World War II began. And the last battles of World War II were actually fought near my hometown, a few months even after Germany capitulated. So I think it's in Europe's, actually the world's interest to, you know, start the second half, what I call this process, and rearrange Bosnia and really, you know, politically move the leaders, move the bad leaders out of their cushions. It is a region where, you know, Eastern and Western cultures meet. And, you know, I think in the book, it seems like you read a good amount. I'm very happy. And, you know, the mojo I have is rewriting our history, Bosniak history, because most of old Yugoslavian history was told and written by Serbs politicians in Belgrade.
Mm.
And the most recent books on Yugoslavian conflict were written by, of course, older acclaimed, brilliant Western journalists like Americans.
Mm-hmm.
But when Susan and I sat down, we decided not to write only another strictly political academic book. We wanted to write a story through the eyes of a 12-year-old boy juxtaposed with perspective of a 30-year-old American citizen.
I read every word of the Bosnia list, and I was fascinated because, as you say, these are viewpoints that are not widely known in the United States. And as a matter of fact, a number of years ago, we had the late Ambassador Richard Holbrooke on the program. If you could say anything to him, what would you tell him?
I would ask him whether he regrets creating the Serb Republic. I would ask him, if you can go back in time, would you have created Dayton, or would you just let everything just end on its own?
Hmm.
And you know, and then people might say that this sounds very insensitive, but that would mean more people would die. And my answer is always, was D-Day worth it? Imagine D-Day, you land at the beach, and after the battle, they say, nope, pull back now, go back to France, go back to Canada, go back to the United States. The war ended. Germans keep everything from whatever, Rhine River. Even Battle of the Bulge. Let's say you go through the Battle of the Bulge, and they say, well, you can't cross over from Belgium into Germany. You have to stay right here. You know, Jews remain in the camps. And if D-Day never happened, I believe there would be two nations in Europe. It would be Soviet Union, and it would be Germany.
Hmm.
But that's for another discussion. That's
another subject entirely, isn't
yeah.
it? The book is The Bosnia List, A Memoir of War, Exile, and Return. Our guest is Kenan Trbinčević, and he wrote it with Susan Shapiro. You're a busy guy. I talked to your publicist for, a while, trying to get you to have a little slot in your schedule. You're a physical therapist. You work hard, don't you?
Yeah. I'm a physical therapist at Shift Physical Therapy in Manhattan, and I work 12 to 8. So for the last 2 years, the hardest part was juggling the schedule. So for every free morning, evening, lunch break, bathroom break, evening and weekend, I was on the phone texting, emailing, or even meeting in person with Susan.
Uh-huh.
And just writing all the time on the subways, buses, any chance I had, on top of doing, you know, physical therapy paperwork and being there for people. So most of my mornings are available. And I was really happy that I was able to accommodate you. And again, I thank you for having me on your show.
Well, I'm glad we were able to finally get you on. And you've mentioned your parents in passing, but we haven't really talked about your brother. He's 6 years older than you, and I'm kind of guessing that maybe he was your mentor. He was sort of your role model.
My brother is 6 years older than me, Eldon. And in Bosnia, I was probably more of a tick to him, and he resented me for being a younger brother. Pain behind. However, I feel that what we went through, even when we left Bosnia, we began to feel closer. And I think both of us were forced to become very mature in many ways, especially taking care of our parents. So felt like a team. And I feel like, you know, he's a part of me. He's like my best friend. So especially when we went to Bosnia, he kept me in check to stay out of trouble. And he would constantly preach to me. You know, you live in America now. We live in a country that's given us opportunity. You have wonderful friends, coworkers, and colleagues who have been very sensitive and supportive of us. You know, don't throw your future away. when we visit the country, just remember we have a better life now than they do, even though we're exiled. So, you know, that helped a lot going there and processing everything. And especially with the writing of the book, I was really, you know, I felt I was reluctant to show him what I wrote. And when he read it, of course, I wanted to make sure he doesn't feel exploited, because I think the book is very revealing, and it makes you feel naked in a way. The first thing he said was, when he walked in the door, he barged in, and he was so mad at one point because he said, "I can't believe that the teacher did that to you." He's like, "You never told us." And I said, "Of course." I'm like, "If I told you, you guys would never let me go outside to get anything for you." So I never did. Same thing with the neighbor who shot through my water canister. Same thing. But he felt that he never knew the side of me. He never thought this is the way I felt. And as a family in most Balkanites, we don't sit around the dining room table burning each other with whatever's going on in our minds, because most of our lives we had something to worry about. So, you know, we're more of an observant than someone that will like to talk about it. But I feel that the book was very also healing for him as well.
Well, it is a very powerful book, and you don't hold back your feelings. You describe going to a nightclub there in New York with your brother, and it was a place that attracted a lot of former residents of the former Yugoslavia. And when they start playing a song performed by Arkan's widow, you just, oh, that's just too much for you, isn't it? You just can't believe it.
Well, I was underage, and I never got to experience my people's bar. Never walked into a bar, have a Bosnian drink, listen to Bosnian music, and just mingle with people from my background. But of course, when the music changes, everything changes. The music tends to be very ethnocentric. It has its deep roots within society. And at first, music was very neutral, where all sides liked it. But when I heard Teta, and right away the switch just went off. And, you know, a lot of her songs are dedicated to Arkan, her husband. It's also the accent. She sings it in, and you know, those are the accents you used to hear. We used to hear when they used to kick us off at the border checkpoints, with profanity. So I said, okay, I came to the United States. You know, I don't have post-traumatic stress disorder. I never lost sleep over it. But at least if I'm going to go have a drink, I really don't need to hear her.
Well, we really appreciate your time today.
Of course.
My guest has been Kenan Trbinčević. The book, The Bosnia List, a memoir of war, exile, and return. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McInnes. Tune in next week when we'll have some poetry for you, a new collection by Herbert Woodward Martin. It's called On the Flyleaf. Herb will be reading some poems from it, and we'll be talking to him about his love for Paul Laurence Dunbar and his poetry, Dayton's most famous poet, who died in 1906. That's the Book Nook next week. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.